Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. Today I'll be discussing the week's television with Alice Vincent, arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph. She'll be guiding us through a sobering new documentary by Louis Theroux on the effect of alcoholism called Drinking to Oblivion. And then we'll discuss a couple of HBO's most anticipated shows this week, the new season of Game of Thrones and, of course, Silicon Valley. All that ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. We'll begin today's show with the latest documentary from intrepid investigator Louis Theroux. Drinking to Oblivion is the first film Theroux has made in the UK for quite some time. It sees him plant himself in King's College Hospital in London, which specialises in liver care. And there he meets a group of alcoholics who give him an insight into their lives. Before we talk about it, though, let's hear a clip of the BBC documentary. Here, Louis meets relapsed alcoholic Joe in hospital.
I'm going to leave now.
Well, I would wait for the doctor.
No, I think I'm going to leave. Come with me if you like.
I would stay, Joe, I really would.
I just want to go and get a bottle of vodka.
What makes you think you'd like to do that?
I like the sensation as it goes down my throat. And I want to experience that for one last time. That's why I'm leaving.
Louis Theroux and Joe there in the new documentary, Drinking to Oblivion. Alice Vincent, thanks very much for being here. I'm getting a feeling that, quite predictably enough, this must feel quite hopeless, I suppose, spending so much time around people with such deep and dark problems. How did the documentary come together and how did it feel as you were watching it?
I mean, it's not a happy watch, let's be honest, Ben. But it is really interesting, actually, to see Louis back on kind of his home turf. I mean, he's got dual nationality with American passport and British passport. But as you say, we've not seen him in the UK for a long time. And from a personal point of view, the hospital is about 100 yards away from where I live. So it was very interesting to see him walking around South London and see him engaging with people there. And I think what comes across more interestingly in that case is that when Louis's in America, he's very much the uptight BBC Brit. Whereas when he's in London, or he's in the UK, he's just like another person and he's extraordinary at what he does in a whole new way.
How much of that is down to perception, though? Because I'm thinking that, I mean, his journalistic style is quite different, but put him in an American setting and he might come across that way. But is it really because we're just comparing him to his American counterparts and maybe when he comes home here he's somehow kind of become a blend of both influences?
It's an interesting point to raise because I think maybe he, in this documentary, he dialed down the kind of slightly cutesy, prodding, but slightly subversive question nature that he adopts so readily in America, because I don't think it would fly here. As with regards to the documentary itself, it followed the sort of traditional format of his shows, which tends to be picking a few characters, in this case three, and following them over the course of a number of months to see what their situations progress.
What role does he play in this, though? Because we have seen documentaries like this in the past. Obviously, there are quite a few of them. But for Louis Theroux, he is quite a personality himself. So when he throws himself into these situations, by the nature of the beast, he is impacting the course of events somewhat simply by being there. It's quite different to a fly on the wall documentary where it feels as though the cameras are part of the walls and no one knows they're there, isn't it?
Yeah, and in this one, it was felt particularly because these people were particularly lonely and had a particularly poor support network. So for a couple of them, like Louis was one of the greatest friends they'd had in recent times. You know, he listened and he was there to support them when their families and friends had kind of given up on them. And that, in a way, made it quite difficult to watch, but also, I imagine, for him, quite difficult to film, because if you get too involved with your subject, then you're not making a documentary. You're getting too involved with the path of what would naturally happen.
What about the locations for the film? I mean, just judging from that clip, obviously quite a bit of it takes place in a hospital, presumably. Yeah. Do we get to see some of the home lives and maybe social lives of some of the characters involved here too?
Yeah, so actually he does more in the homes and he goes into these flats, as I said, in like Brixton and another place in South London, Camberwell, stuff like that. That's an insight as well, because some of them, well, how often do you get to see inside the home of an alcoholic? And I think that was actually a part where it's a shame that this documentary isn't longer, more a greater series, because it was only so deep. We didn't get to learn more about their home lives or the psychological treatment they were going through or the circumstances which had put them in this situation.
So obviously it's trying to paint a portrait of some people here, but what are some of the bigger questions that Louis is trying to ask? Or I suppose more importantly, is he trying to ask any larger questions about maybe how people become involved in this vicious cycle of alcoholism and dependence on some form of addiction?
That was definitely part of it. And a lot of his interview strategy was about, well, how do you get in this situation? What were you drinking? How long were you sober for? What happened? And you learn the stories, you know, there was a bad breakup, there was a fear of rejection, etc. But it's interesting because I thought it was going to be more of a documentary about British drinking culture as a wider whole, and certainly the kind of the middle-aged, middle-class drinking crisis, which isn't actually massively documented and would make, I think, a perfect Louis Theroux subject. And he didn't touch on that at all. Maybe he's keeping his gunpowder dry for another day.
Maybe it's the whole documentary has given light to maybe a slightly more fascinating question that we're yet to see the answer to.
Absolutely, I'd say so.
That is Louis Theroux, Drinking to Oblivion. It's available to watch now on BBC iPlayer right here in the UK. Now we'll change pace for the return of the HBO comedy Silicon Valley. The programme, which has just entered a third season, follows a group of tech entrepreneurs trying to make it big in California. Alice, bring us up to speed on the series so far and where we picked things up in the first episode, which aired just on Sunday.
Over the past two seasons, Silicon Valley has sort of followed this one plucky entrepreneur who invented the kind of the algorithm of a lifetime. And he's called Richard Hendricks. At the end of season two, we were left on this cliffhanger where he'd kind of been fired from his own company. And season three comes in and the character has developed from this kind of plucky go-getter to a complete egomaniac with loads of money and loads of power, and who's suddenly the table's been turned. The closest comparison to me at the moment feels like that moment when Don Draper was fired from the company in Mad Men. You know, you just, wow, okay, there's this sort of weird power vacuum.
Suddenly he owns his legacy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And a new boss has come in. His co-workers are trying to support Richard, but also know that he's a bit of a fool, and comedy ensues.
Mm-hmm. So how has the response been so far, do you think? Because, of course, being an HBO series, it is, by the nature of its existence and who makes it, it is subject to slightly higher levels of critique.
The thing is that Silicon Valley has always garnered really strong reviews. We're talking mid-80s, high 80s on Metacritic. That's a ranking tool that gives you a percentage out of 100. So it's doing really well. First episode back, the critics all seem to love it. It's very funny. It's very relevant. Little things like in the credits, there are references to topical internet in jokes about the nature of startups such as Twitter and things like that. It's still clever. It's still funny.
How difficult do you think it is for the producers of a show like this to keep it grounded somewhat in reality? Because even when you described the nature of where the company inside, the fictional company inside Silicon Valley is coming from, I mean, he invented an algorithm. Do we get some sort of insight into what that algorithm is and the function that it is performing? Or is that just necessarily a mysterious thing with questions that you do not ask?
I wouldn't say it's a MacGuffin as such. What is interesting about it is those are the questions that have dogged Silicon Valley. And for the most part, it's actually been kind of painfully true to life, mostly because creator Mike Judge, who has previously worked on like Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill, he quit Silicon Valley to go and play bass in a band and like become a comedy writer. So there is a lot of truth in there. At the same time, I think sometimes a lot of the characterisation tends to err on the Big Bang Theory side of subtlety, as in not subtle at all, and very much like, oh, I'm a nerd, I can't talk to girls. And I think evidence would suggest that programmers and entrepreneurs have come a long way from there.
Oh, Big Bang Theory in the world of HBO, that's like a curse word, isn't it?
Kind of, just on the very remits at the worst possible time. I think most people would say that Silicon Valley is a step up from that. Although Big Bang Theory is ridiculously successful for reasons beyond my understanding.
So. Hopefully with an entirely different crowd.
Yeah.
So that is HBO's new series of Silicon Valley. The next episode will air on HBO this Sunday at 2200. The series will hit Sky Atlantic in the UK next month. Now, finally, Alice, we couldn't get through a TV review this week without talking about Game of Thrones, which has just returned to our screens for a sixth series. The first episode was aired over the weekend on HBO and Sky Atlantic to millions of excited fans. Alice, are you a Game of Thrones fan?
I'm certainly a Game of Thrones observer.
An observer, wow. Yeah, that's interesting because I find that a lot of people either are devoted to it like a second religion or, well, they're just not fussed at all.
Yeah, so I had this kind of slightly strange period of my life where I've watched four seasons of it in as many months. And I guess maybe I was on the brink of fanship then. But no, I keenly watch it. I am vaguely fascinated by it. I think I'm more fascinated by the fandom than I am part of it. I'm into it, but I'm not super into, like, getting obsessed about it. Oh my God.
A lot of people can be. Now, this is, of course, quite controversially, quite famously, the first season where things start to go in their own direction away from the series of books. Mm-hmm. How have you been sensing things have been going?
Well, you know, it's interesting because season five, actually, even though that was technically based on George R.R. Martin's books, started to veer away in very strange and hugely controversial ways anyway.
Hmm.
So there are a couple of scenes which were done differently and which a lot of people, especially viewers who had any sense of women's rights, were thinking, this is kind of weird and misogynistic and not written into the books and doesn't make any sense. And why are the showrunners doing this? So now we're in season six and we're free of the books. And actually, going on the first episode, which is all we've got to go so far, they seem to be doing a good job. I think maybe because there was quite a lot of pressure on them after the controversies of last season.
I mean, a lot of those things that they have used to attract some level of notoriety and get more people talking. I mean, yes, there are the issues of women's rights. There is a lot of nudity and sexual violence involved in a lot of the shows as well. There have been a couple of opinion pieces popping up just recently saying that it has a bit of a penis problem. We've got a lot of female nudity, but not a lot of male nudity to balance it out as well. And that might also represent some sort of misbalance with the gender roles here. Is that something that you've been picking up?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of this has been spearheaded by Emilia Clarke, who plays Daenerys in the show. She's sort of the blonde dragon lady. For people who are not that familiar with it, you'll definitely recognise her. And she has been given a lot of interviews, like all of the cast have. I kind of feel sorry for them at this time. You know, constant junkets. And in it, she's sort of asked the question, and she's just like, oh, I think we should see more penises. And obviously, it's the kind of news line that people like me run away with. To me, I don't really think that they need to do that. I'm not really fussed about seeing any more bits on TV. What was interesting about the first episode was that we actually saw a lot of women taking charge. We saw a lot of women like making allegiances. We saw a lot of women like quite literally stabbing people in the back. I think that's a more interesting development if you really want to balance the gender issues.
What about the stories, though? Because it made such a name for itself, especially in season one, with the way it could shock you. It could take you down this path and lure you into a sense of false security and then quickly turn around at the last minute. And that is, I think, one of the major key reasons that people keep coming back for more. Does it still have that ability? Is its sword still as sharp as it was?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one question that has literally filled fans' minds for an entire year is whether a character called Jon Snow is dead or alive. And this kind of weird Elvis conspiracy theory, because even though all evidence would suggest he is dead, nobody can believe it. Everyone is in like Jon Snow death denial. I mean, that just shows you how attached people are to these characters, how confident they are in completely crazy things happening just to see the storylines they want to play out.
Well, let's quickly take a listen to some of the trailer for season six of Game of Thrones.
A girl has been given a second chance. There will not be a third.
That's all I think about. What was taken from me.
I know what happens.
There's no hiding from this. We have to fight.
Stand at the head of our army where you belong. Show them what Lannisters are. What we do to our enemies.
Frightening stuff. Alice, do you have a particular side that you're on when we're talking about the thrones here, the thrones behind the game?
It's a tricky one because there are goodies and baddies in all of it. I'd say probably I'm House Lannister. They are the kind of the most Machiavellian ones. In that clip there, you heard when he said, show us what, you know, let them see what we do to our enemies. That's House Lannister through and through. There's a lot of them left, and they have the most interesting characters.
There we go. Alice Vincent certainly has a dark side after all. That was Game of Thrones, currently airing on HBO and Sky Atlantic. Look out for the second episode this weekend. I'm sure plenty of people will be. That indeed brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to Alice Vincent. You have been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Ryland. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll have Charmaine Lovegrove in to talk about books. But for now, from me, thanks very much for listening.